Welcome to the MacArthur Memorial Podcast, where we explore the life and times of General of the Army Douglas MacArthur and delve into the history of World War I, World War II, and the Korean War.
Those interested in the history of the Philippines or World War II know of the bombing of Clark Field on December 8, 1941, a few hours right after the destruction of Pearl Harbor. And it was the destruction of American air power in the Philippines at the outset of the war in the Pacific. Most people, however, they don't know the history of Clark Field. And that is what we're here to talk about today with Dr. Rick Meixel of James Madison University, author of Clark Field and the U.S. Army Air Corps in the Philippines. Dr. Meixel, let's set the stage and begin. What was or is Clark Field, Clark Air Base in the Philippines?
To start at the beginning, a little before the formation of Clark, the Army has great ambition when it goes to the Philippines early in the century. It plans to stay a long time, to keep a lot of soldiers there, to have some involvement in the future development of America's relationship with the Philippines. And part of that was putting bases, posts, Army posts, throughout the archipelago, one of which became known as Camp Stotzenberg, a large post, the largest by acreage, the largest post in the Army outside of the United States for some time. And that was placed just outside Angeles in Pampanga in 1902. And then when air power arrives in the Philippines after World War I, that because it's an existing Army post and it's large and has space, then an airfield is placed there as well. And it turned out to be more successful than the other, more appropriate than the other airfields, and so it became more prominent and longer lasting.
Now, you talk about Camp Stotzenberg. Now, who was that named after?
Well, that is named after, as posts were at the time, some of them anyway, after prominent American soldiers who had been killed fighting in the Philippine-American War. Stotzenberg, John Stotzenberg, colonel, commanding officer of the Nebraska Regiment.
Now, you talk about in the book that Camp Stotzenberg is one of nine zones that they create in the Philippines as bases to basically control the Philippines. Now, is this Leonard Wood's plan, or is this the Army's plan, or?
I think I wrote in there something about there being nine posts.
Right, exactly.
Spaced throughout the Luzon diagonally and horizontally to... vertically and horizontally to control the population and defend from possible invasion. That was not Leonard Wood. That predates Leonard Wood.
Okay.
What Leonard Wood's unique contribution was as commanding general of the Department of the Philippines was to turn Stotzenberg into a massive post. It was under his authority that it went from being a few thousand acres to 150,000. And he did that purposely because he wanted the Army to prepare for war. He wanted to get rid of the 30-year private, the traditional regimental soldiering, and have a modern Army that spent its time preparing for war.
Right.
And here was a big open space to do it, and no political opposition because it's the Philippines, where Filipinos don't really have a voice.
And it's pretty remote from Manila as well. Is there a reason why they put it so distant? And basically, there's very few ways to get there when they really open it at the beginning, at the turn of the century.
Well, there's a railroad that runs through the center of Luzon, and in that sense, it's remote. There are posts in Manila, of
course.
Was
that built by the Spanish, the railroad?
I think it was an English contract.
An English, but, okay, right.
During the Spanish period. So, the population of the Philippines was so much smaller then, wasn't it? About 7 million, maybe, and today it's around 100 million.
Right.
So even though it's like 50 miles north, and maybe it doesn't seem like it's remote, it's a ways away, and there's plenty of room to expand.
And all these trails that go to in and out of the area. And a very famous song came out of Camp Stotzenberg,
yeah, that's
didn't
right.
it?
That's right. Once a famous... event, I suppose, known to all soldiers. There was an old trail that dated from the Spanish period that ran along the northern edge of Camp Stotzenberg, the part that extended well into Tarlac Province. And, who was that guy? Ira Gruber?
And it's the Army caisson song, Over Hill, Over Dale, and that comes from the Philippines.
And supposedly those words occurred to him as he was listening to waiting for an artillery batteries to move along that road.
Now, when do the first airplanes come into the Philippines? Before World War I.
It's before World War I. So there are airplanes in the Philippines. It's sort of a novelty idea at that time. Look, we've got this interesting new thing. I wonder what we can do with it. So they're mostly seaplanes.
And you talk about a guy named Vernon Burge that was one of the first pilots that comes over there.
Yeah, but an enlisted man. And they don't have enough officer pilots, so they open... accept applications from interested enlisted men. I believe he worked with airplanes. And so, I believe he was the first...
Now, this plane that they uncrate over there, is it like a Wright flyer?
Book, I talk about how that's how they get airplanes to the Philippines. There's early de Havillands, was they come in crates.
Mm.
And when you get it, you uncrate it and put the thing together.
Right.
But those were the de Havillands that I spoke of in the book,
Now, what happened at Stotzenberg in World War I? It kind of clears out, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a real backwater. I didn't mention it in the book, but there's actually once a fairly well-known book called Too Many Boats by an Army officer. It's a novel, but it's set at Stotzenberg in World War I. And what it's about is how unhappy all the officers are, how bored they are, how unhappy they are that they're stuck in the Philippines while everyone else is going off to war. So, it was a backwater in World War I. That probably its most famous officer, not at the time, but later, was the first black general.
Oh, right.
Was the provost marshal at Stotzenberg.
Because the cavalry units were there.
Yeah, the 9th Cavalry Regiment was there,
Wow. Now, Charles Menaher, and he's MacArthur's commander in World War I, but after the war, he takes over the Army's air corps, and he's the guy who really pushes for the Philippines. Can you talk about that Philippine project and Ira Eaker that goes over there?
Yeah, there was some concern around 1919 that the United States, there was something of a war scare with Japan, and there was a need to rush resources to American outposts in the Pacific, and a realization that they didn't have any airplanes over there. There had been some before the war. They had crashed or been damaged, and the squadron had left. It had been operating from Corregidor, and the war
ends.
Because
they have a field on Corregidor Island.
Sort of.
Yeah.
It was a seaplane base and balloons there. But they did have a little landing field, which they did give a name to.
Kinley Field, right.
But there was this sudden realization of the weakness of American military forces in the Far East. Let's get some forces over there. And so they had a quite ambitious plan to send several air squadrons. Nothing much came of it in the long run, but in the immediacy, some men were rushed over, some planes were rushed over. Ira Eaker was one of them. An officer who was thinking about getting out of the Army once the war was over, going back to college, and thought that sounded interesting, heard about it. The request for officers happened to come across his desk, so he added his name to the list. I don't think I put in the book, but I remember reading that a number of men had been listed, and he put his name on it, and theirs were all crossed off by someone, and his was left on.
Mm.
So he...
And he becomes very famous in World War II, doesn't
he?
Yeah.
And because of his fame in World War II as commander of the 8th Air Force, then what little you could learn about the Philippine, about Clark, when I was a kid there in the 60s and 70s, was whatever it was, Ira Eaker did it.
Really?
He
was the legend of the base,
He was the only famous guy who had been at Stotzenberg back when it was beginning to be turned into an air base in 1919.
Now, the 1920s, Clark really starts growing, and they get the 3rd Aero Squadron.
Well, maybe it doesn't grow too much, but they do put some permanent facilities down. They do have this 3rd Aero Squadron that lays out the base and is stationed there for the next 20 years or so.
Back in the United States, are they really wary of putting money into this?
Yes. Or,
but there are some that are for it, some that are against it.
Yeah, there's a burst of enthusiasm and concern in 1919. Let's rush all these resources. Let's build these bases. Where can we put them? Well, we just happen to have this big base, Stotzenberg, a natural place, and we don't have any concerns with civilians about who owns the property, as they did in Manila, for example. But that soon goes away. Whatever drove that enthusiasm, nothing comes of it. And so they don't really put a whole lot of resources into it in the 1920s, but some.
But when did they start building, like, the Nichols Field or the Nielsen Field? You know,
well,
there are other
these,
bases.
All of these things date to that 1919 time period.
Okay.
Not Nielsen, that's separate.
Okay.
But Kinley Field being built up. If you've been there today and you see that little dirt airstrip,
yes.
It's hard to think that, that if you're in the Air Corps or the Air Service in the early 1920s and you go to the Philippines, this is where you were going to be stationed. Not Manila, not Clark. A few, but mostly you're going to be on Kinley Field, on the tail end of Corregidor. But again, there is Nichols Field. I think, as I explain in the book, they're looking for a place to put a field in Manila. They have problems getting the land they need, so they already had that little post that was connected to Fort McKinley, and they just turned that into an airfield.
Now, as far as Clark and Stotzenberg in these early days, there's the relationship between the American military, the civilian population, American military, Philippine military. There's really established codes of society that underlie everything, isn't there?
As I explain in the book, there's not a lot of interaction between the Filipino and American communities. The Americans come over. It's a two-year tour of duty for the most part. They're socially rather isolated. They socialize amongst themselves. They dream up things to keep themselves active. Where do Filipinos fit in? Well, they make life easy. They're servants. You know, you hire three or four or five to make life comfortable. But you don't learn the language. You don't see a lot of the country.
So it is a lot of a colonial mindset that's going on.
It is very, very much so. I think I mentioned in the book talking to the late Colonel Tom Jones, who had been stationed there just before the war, and he said he could only remember one time when they had a social event that they purposely invited Filipinos to participate in. And he meant Filipino military officers, not the Filipino civilians.
Now, are scouts, Philippine scouts, are they located at Stotzenberg and Clark during this time?
Yeah, Stotzenberg essentially became a scout base in the 20s. As the Americans go home after World War I, the infantry, some of it stays in the Philippines, but most of it goes home at that time, infantry and cavalry regiments, particularly the cavalry regiments that had been the mainstay at Stotzenberg before World War I, and they're replaced by these Philippine scouts. A scout cavalry regiment is there. Scout field artillery regiment is there. There's Clark Field, and there are Americans at Clark Field because Filipinos weren't allowed to serve in the air service. But that's a small part of the larger.
So there, at this point, there is no training of any kind of Philippine pilots or anything.
There was the World War I effort to have pilots with the Philippine National Guard, but done away with by Wood, Leonard Wood, after he becomes Governor General, mostly for economic reasons, I think.
Now, in the 1930s, and this is kind of off the subject of Clark and Stotzenberg, but it really affects MacArthur history. In the book, you talk about when General Gruner in the late 30s comes in, they really increase the size of the scout regiments. And they bring in a lot of these people that had been trained with the Philippine Army already. And when they make this, they say that after 6 months that most of these new scouts are just as, you can't distinguish them from the old scouts. When MacArthur is building his army, after he gets brought back as his safety commander, and he says, I only need about 6 months to train this army, into April 42. Do you think he's looking at that example of when they brought in all these scouts from the Philippine Army?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the late 30s. Of course, we're talking about 1941. Remember, Grunert becomes commanding general of the Philippine Department. I guess it was in 40. He's pushing the War Department, give me more resources, give me more resources. And they start to send him stuff. Some airplanes begin to go over in late 1940. Remembering that MacArthur is retired from the U.S.
Right.
Army at this time, and he's not going to be recalled to active duty until the end of July 1941. So it's not really his decision-making at this time. He's back there in the background, presumably has some influence, but is really increasingly marginalized. It's Grunert who thinks that he's going to be in charge.
Exactly.
And he's, under his leadership, the garrison's going to be built up. And he gets Congress, or gets the War Department to agree to increase the size of the Philippine Scouts. The Philippine Scouts, the size of it, the size it can be, is set by law way back in 1901. It says 12,000. And Congress can change that law, but that would be time-consuming and controversial.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, well, we've got 6,000 in under arms right now. We'll recruit 6,000 more. And he ensures to take those 6,000 from volunteers who had already completed Philippine Army training. And so, yes, people who were there at the time and saw this process thought, you know, in a remarkably short period of time, these guys have become professional soldiers capable of helping us defend the Philippines. So then MacArthur comes into office, is recalled to active duty July 26, 1941. Well, he's aware of what has happened,
right?
You know, and there's an idea, well, let's just get congressional approval to expand the Philippine Scouts and build up those regiments by bringing in more Philippine Army trainees. He thought that was would be a political problem, that you had to mobilize the Philippine Army as the Philippine Army, even if that might reduce, you know, its trainability. I think the thinking was that they would cadre those Philippine Scout units,
right,
bring in more American officers, because that was the real thing that they didn't want to say out loud, that MacArthur didn't want to say out loud, that Grunert didn't want to say out loud. Filipinos are fine soldiers, not under Filipino officers.
Right.
But if you're going to mobilize the Philippine Army, make it a national effort, get everyone on board, you can't just say, we'll take the warm bodies we need and put them under American command. You have to bring everyone on board. And if that means they don't get trained quite as rapidly and you have to accept some officers that maybe you wish you didn't have to, well, that's not knowing Japan is going to attack in December 1941, then you think you've got the time. You know, that's a better way,
sure,
to mobilize forces, to mobilize public opinion, to make it everyone's war.
And in 40-41, with the influx of the air power that's coming, do you think that's Grunert that spurs that on?
Well, Grunert is pushing it.
Yeah.
And so, of course, he wants the air Corps squadrons that are starting to arrive at the end of late 1940. You know, whether the idea of bringing, sending over bombers, you know, that is a debate going on back in the States at that time. And Grunert is participating, but he's not the one, I don't think, pushing to have bomber squadrons sent over.
Right.
In the way that they were. That's really a decision made very, very late in the day, right?
By the War Department.
Toward the end,
yeah,
of 41, actually. Okay, we've said no up until this time, but now we're sort of mesmerized by what the B-17, the B-24 can do. Let's rush him over to the Philippines, and that alone should stay Japan's hand, make the Japanese see how unwise it would be. But of course, the Japanese thinking was, well, we need to attack now, before more and more stuff comes over, and we can't attack later.
Now, the bombing of Clark Field on December 8th is still a subject of great debate, and tons of books have been written about it. But what happens to Clark after the destruction, you know, in that period during the Philippine campaign?
Well, as you say, the Japanese attack around 12:30, December 8th, 1941, through a series of just bad luck, poor decision-making, not foreseeing how things might play out. A substantial part of the bomber force is caught on the ground there. So thereafter, Clark becomes what some had envisioned it being anyway, a sort of staging area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, move what remains of the bombing force further away where the Japanese can't get at it, and then use Clark as a forward staging area to launch raids up toward Formosa. You know, Colin Kelly does his thing at that time. So you still got
facilities working there.
Yeah. And some damaged B-17s are repaired. So it is still an operational base, but the units have moved out into the surrounding area, so they're not targets of Japanese attack thereafter. And then, of course, December 24th, the word just sort of goes around. I'm not sure anyone really knows who is the originator of these things, but the word sort of goes around, we're pulling out, and everyone beats feet out of the area,
right.
Even though the Japanese are still a week away.
Now, the Colin Kelly raid, and he gets the Distinguished Service Cross for this.
Right.
What really did or did not happen?
Not a whole lot happened. Hey, some B-17s went up to attack approaching Japanese transports and ships, and his was one. It flew up. It apparently attacked a ship. Not clear that it actually hit anything, but the plane was shot down. He was killed trying to return to the south, and given. The lack of achievement, of accomplishment at the time, it was seized upon as a heroic act.
As one of the war's first real
gravitating
heroes.
He was the first West Point graduate killed in action in World War II.
Hmm. Now, what did the Japanese do with Clark Field?
They developed it in a way the Americans hadn't. They put an extensive system of landing strips, 10 or 12 of them, where Clark Field itself had been further to the north of Mabalak and Bam Bam. You know, they had airstrips throughout that area and used it as a base for attacking approaching Americans in October of 44.
As a kamikaze strip.
So it said.
Yeah.
I think different authorities on the kamikazes point to different dates but that's one of them that's given.
Now, after the liberation in 45, Clark is a major air base for the United States Air Force until its closing in the 80s.
91.
Right, okay.
After the Pinatubo.
And you have a pretty close connection with Clark, don't you?
Well, we lived there. My dad got assigned to Clark in 65. And he was on an accompanied tour, but there were so many men going in there that... Even if you were on an accompanied, because of the support of the war in Vietnam.
Mm.
And so you couldn't take your family. You had to put your name on a housing list, first off base and then on base. And then after a few months go by, you can invite them. They can come over to the Philippines. So that's when we first went there in February of 66 and began to get acquainted with. At least I did. I took an interest
with the history.
In the history, and we were later there in the early 70s, and I did a work study with, I think it was the 405th Fighter Wing History Office, and so I had an opportunity to learn more about Clark's history.
Well, we thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email amanda.williams@norfolk.gov.